We've made it to a Thursday here on Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a little bit later today, Dave Thompson, our longtime news director, and I will review this week's news in North Dakota. And we have a film buff alert. Matt Olien counts down picks number 20 through 11 from his all-time list of favorite films. He'll have some bold choices, some hidden gems, and maybe even a hot take or two, and we'll see if you agree with Matt's list. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. And we begin Main Street today with Essentia Health CEO, Dr. David Herman. Welcome, Dr. Herman, to Main Street.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to meet with you today.
You're joining us to discuss your new role as the chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association, and we want to talk about the urgent challenges and hopes shaping the future of healthcare in our region. And I'd like to start there if I could. As chair of the Hospital Association in Minnesota, what are your top priorities, would you tell me, for the year? And it seems to me that this is maybe an uncertain time for healthcare systems.
It is an uncertain time for healthcare systems. And I think that things have been uncertain for a long period of time with challenges. I do think that this year is a little bit different, where things are probably, you know, going from volatile to chaotic with changes on a daily basis. But as we think about healthcare, and we're really privileged to live here in Minnesota and North Dakota, where there's really a diversity of healthcare experiences. We have large urban areas, small rural areas, each of them with a unique challenges, but each of them with a common goal, and that's better health for the people that we're privileged to serve.
You've talked about innovation and advocacy as essential tools in the healthcare environment. And I'm wondering what you thought this morning when the House passed the beautiful tax bill that impacts things like Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
What went through your mind?
Well, the first thing that went through my mind is there's still a lot of work to do on that. I think that there is a legislative process, and then there's conversations, and we've tried to spend a lot of time telling our story. And our story is really not the story about hospitals, facilities, or clinics. The story that we like to tell is about our patients. And the most critical thing for our patients is health. And one of the most critical tools we have is access to the healthcare system. So the things that we've focused on is talking about, there's one out of five Americans is funded by Medicaid in some way, shape, or form. About 40% of children. About, when what other people don't recognize, is about 60% of people in skilled nursing facilities or nursing homes are funded by that. So there are a lot of incredibly vulnerable people in every state, no matter which state you talk about, that receive their health care and their access to health care through Medicaid. So we've been telling most of those stories with people and really bringing it down to the personal level. It's one thing to be able to sit around a table, whether it's in Bismarck, St. Paul, or Washington, D.C., and talk about the dollars and talk about a program. It's really another thing to talk about the people that the program serves.
So are you concerned, perhaps, that access will not be enhanced?
I am concerned. Mm-hmm. And here's the challenge, I believe, Craig, is that we can change the program, but it does not change the people's need for health care. And those people will show up, whether it's at our clinics or our emergency room, whether they have that insurance that they receive through Medicaid or not. And our concern is that they will show up sicker further along the line, which is much more likely to raise the cost of their care than decrease the cost of their care. The other part of it is that when someone walks into our emergency room, we pay the same to the wonderful staff that care for them, regardless if we get paid or not. And so when that happens and there's a lot of care that's being provided, what we'd say uncompensated, that cost of care gets shifted to others. And it gets shifted to others not in the Medicare program or another government program. It gets shifted to what we would call the commercial base, people that either get insurance through their employer or buy insurance through the marketplace.
So me, do I have to pay more?
You will.
In this vision?
You will. Because somewhere along the line, someone has to pay that nurse for that care. And so what that means is that it's likely to affect commercial rates. Those will need to go up to pay for the cost of care. And that mostly falls to the burden of businesses. And since most of the businesses in America are small business, those small business owners that are already struggling to pay for the cost of health care.
So if I were to ask you the most pressing policy issue for hospitals in North Dakota and Minnesota, you would respond?
Access to care. And that access to care, whether it's compensated or uncompensated, people need that care. I would also say that there's a better way to deliver care than we are delivering it right now. And what I would say to that is, when you hear the term volume to value, what that means is that what are the things that I can do for you at this particular point in time, when you're either you're healthy or sometimes when you think you're healthy and you may not be, for you to be able to continue that your health and not need that care. There's really three things that drive the cost of care. It's how much we pay for the care on the unit basis. So how much does a heart surgery cost? You can decrease the cost of care by paying less for that. How many people need that care and get that access to that? And then what's the health status of someone when they come in? We know that if we're going to really affect health care, the thing we can all agree on is we'd all like to be healthy. The hospital that we're sitting in here today is full. Our hospital in Duluth is full. Craig, I can tell you that there's nobody that's in that hospital that wants to be in that hospital. They're probably grateful to be there to get the care that they want. But if there is something we could have done 3 days ago, 3 weeks ago, or 3 months ago to keep them out of the hospital, they would be grateful if we did that.
It bothers me that somebody in an insurance office far away from the hospitals where I'm receiving care is making decisions about my health.
Yes.
From your perspective, what are your thoughts about that?
I think that's challenging, and particularly challenging for people in rural areas. And I will tell you a story that I can't give you the names on, but the story is a true story. Someone comes from Ely, Minnesota. It's a 75-year-old woman who has a dry, unproductive cough and was a smoker for many, many years until she quit about 5 years ago. She's also lost 15 pounds over the last 3 months. So she goes to see her doctor, and when we hear that story, even if you're not a physician, you know that there's something that's not very good going on. Her physician does a chest x-ray, sits down with her and says, "We see a shadow on your lung. I'm going to send you to Duluth. I want you to meet with a pulmonologist to see how we can get what we need to do next." Pulmonologist sees her and says, "We need to get a CT scan and an MRI of that lung so we can characterize that lump there, that shadow that we see there, and then we'll need to make the next steps." And her insurance company says, "I'm sorry, this needs to go through prior authorization." So she's already here in Duluth. They've traveled about 3 hours. Her son or daughter has taken time off work to bring her there. And now she has to go back home and wait to hear from the insurance company. While the clock's ticking for a test that we all know that she needs. There's got to be a better way to do that. I do understand that prior authorization is aimed with a very laudable goal, is to make sure that people get the care they need. And
isn't
none of the care
the doctor's
they don't
role?
Need. That is the doctor's role. Can we all be reliably entrusted to do that? I would say much more than the insurance companies believe we need to be on that. So that's where it personally affects the patient, and particularly someone from a rural area. If she lived across the street from the doctor's office, there's that cost of time, but there's not the cost of travel and taking the cost off work. There are better ways to do that.
Let's step back to the rural issue that you've talked about.
Yes.
Relative to Medicaid, perhaps reductions that are coming down the way. Are you concerned that healthcare will become more and more centralized in communities like Fargo, which I'm so impressed with what's available here, but I don't live in Bowman.
Right.
Or somewhere in rural North Dakota. Yeah.
Yes, by necessity it will. I think there is a belief that if we cut the funding for Medicaid, that it only affects the people that are receiving Medicaid, and that's not the case. When we cut funding for Medicaid, the care, as we just talked about, still needs to be delivered, needs to be delivered in an uncompensated manner. Can the small rural hospital or the rural clinic be able to assume that burden of the cost of care that they are providing to people who show up? And both by an ethical reasons and by law, they need to serve. That will put that access. There are many hospitals in North Dakota, many hospitals in rural America in general that are struggling right now. And this will not make their job any easier from a financial standpoint.
So with the hospitals in your network that you're in charge of, Dr. Herman, are you already then preparing for decreased reimbursements, and what are you doing?
We are spending some time looking at all the options. Our first option is to say, okay, what can we do to maintain access for healthcare within that community? Does it require just reducing the number of services there? Does it require closing that facility? At the end of the day, the only way we can keep facilities open is to be able to make sure that we can pay everybody that works there, have a sufficient bottom line to continue to invest in our people, invest in our facilities. This will make it more difficult. There will be operational challenges and difficult decisions that will need to be made to keep any and all facilities open.
Do you believe you have allies
from your federal congressional representatives in Minnesota? And are they equal to our delegation here from North Dakota?
I believe that everyone that I've met with is concerned about their constituents and their constituents' access to health care. We have spent most of our time educating them to show them how the decisions that are made as far away as Washington, D.C. change the lives of people in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota. We are hoping to continue those conversations. We're working right now to make it real to them without having it make it real to our patients. So most of this is going to be based upon education.
How about policy leaders at the state level?
It's the same conversation. And I really have empathy for people that are working to make these decisions. There's no one in America that wants to pay more tax. There's no one in America that wants to lose the services that they're having. And we send people to Washington, to Bismarck, and to St. Paul to help make those decisions. Those are incredibly difficult decisions. But we do have to find a way to get people around the table and say what's best for the people we're all privileged to serve, whether as a healthcare provider or as an elected official, and be able to pull those things together.
Before we move on, you grew up in International Falls.
I did.
Canada was a stone's throw away.
Yes.
Is there anything we can take from their healthcare system that would benefit us that we haven't really thought about before?
It's very difficult to compare one healthcare system to another. What we are really the best in the world at here in America is that acute illness, that if you get in a car accident, if you have a pancreatic tumor, this is the best place to get that care. What we could really learn from, whether it's Canada, Norway, or other places, is how do we have health as policy rather than health policy? What are we doing to help keep our population healthy and to avoid needing that care? And there's many things that we can do.
Real simply, I would assume it's your position that healthcare is a right.
I'd say healthcare is a right. I think it's a right for several different reasons. No one wants to be sick. I do think that the way we care for people and the cost of that care falls upon us all. And if we want to spend more money on K-12 education, on roads, bridges, whatever we want to spend it on, we need to really get control of the healthcare costs in America in a way that benefits the people that we're privileged to serve, makes it as cost-effective as it possibly can be, and then allows us to really fund the things besides healthcare, which is almost 20% of the GDP of the United States. And how do we spend our money more effectively for better health outcomes?
We're enjoying our conversation with Essentia Health CEO, Dr. David Herman. He's also the new chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Let's talk about value-based care. It's something that your literature tells me about.
Yes.
First, Essentia Health has long supported that. What is it?
So what value-based care is, planning the care of a population and the individuals in that population to keep them as healthy as possible. There's no one that gets up in the morning that says, I hope I get to see the doctor today, or I hope I end up in the emergency room. Yet there are many things, whether it's lifestyle, behaviors, the way that we eat, quickly identifying diseases such as hypertension and adequately treating those, that if done well and done quickly, can preserve our health and keep us out of the emergency room in the hospital. What value-based care does is it helps you set up a system or a program. The way that healthcare is set up right now is that I don't get paid until you get sick and come into my office or into my hospital. Is there a way where I can identify you, Craig, as a patient that you and I are partnering together on your health, and we're coaching you, we're seeing you on a regular basis to maintain your health through the chronic diseases that you may or may not have, and move that forward? What value-based healthcare is, it designs that system around us to do that. Another example.
Would I subscribe to those services, so to speak?
Yes, subscribe to those services, or a partnership between your insurance company, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, or commercial insurance, and the people that have agreed to assume your care. There's a thing called attribution. So there are patients, because they see us, that are attributed to us, and we become responsible not for just the provision of healthcare services being open when you need to come to the clinic, but a shared responsibility between you and I to keep you healthy. And we work with Medicare on that. We work through Medicaid in Minnesota with a program on that. And then we have some special partnerships with commercial payers. Medica in Minnesota is our best partner on there. Is how do we deliver services that people need? The best model, the best way I can describe as value-based care, is first knowing who your patients are. We're partners on this. Knowing what they need and delivering what they need before they know they need it. keeping them healthy, keeping your blood pressure down. If you have diabetes, keeping your blood sugars under control, making sure you're getting your colonoscopy every 5 years that you need it. If you're a woman, making sure you're getting your breast cancer screening when you need it. Building all of those things into a care model that we partner together. I remind you when you need it. I reach out. The other part of it is care can be delivered in different channels. So if you're a 55-year-old with high blood pressure, do you need to come into the office to have your blood pressure checked? Or for a very reasonable amount of money, about $40, buy something that takes your blood pressure at home and sends it to the clinic and lets your doctor know how you're doing. You don't need to come into the clinic. That reserves that spot in the clinic for the 90-year-old that's developing a cough and it's getting worse. There's only so many slots you can have in a clinic. Who should I be seeing today? Should I be seeing the 55-year-old who I know whose blood pressure, or the 90-year-old whose cough is getting worse that I could probably need to see today?
So you're arguing maybe that technology is a solution, especially for rural care?
I think whether it's rural or urban, I think rural care does have its challenges for some of that technology because of that last mile internet service isn't present for all of us in rural America. And the investments in that would certainly promote volume to value and better healthcare in general.
You spoke about this in context of Medicaid again.
Yes.
Are state policymakers doing all that's required to continue Medicaid expansion and not limit it?
That's a difficult question to say all that's required, because I think we're still discovering our path along the way. But do we need to be more deliberate and have better ideas and pull that together? I think a better partnership between the healthcare system, between the patients that we serve, and by policymakers is something that's very much needed in order for us to navigate these very difficult waters together.
What about workforce? And especially, again, workforce in rural areas. It has to be your top concern, I would guess.
Yes. We have designed the current healthcare system on the largest high school graduating classes, on the largest college graduating classes, those of us that are end at the baby boomer, and those people don't exist anymore. So I think there's probably two primary foci that we need to talk about on that. First of all, how do we keep healthcare as effective as it can possibly be? These are very precious resources. The people, are we using them in the best manner? And then the second part of it is are we giving people the opportunity and the education and the mentorship to take these roles within the healthcare field to be able to deliver that precious care?
As I told you earlier, I came from Wyoming, and the revolving door of young physicians is created because Wyoming doesn't have a medical school. And so our young physicians, they're trained elsewhere with the caveat they need to come back to the state for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then guess what?
Yes.
Off they go.
Yes.
Is that a problem here?
That is. We have found out that where you train is where you will practice. And making training opportunities in Wyoming or other rural areas is very important. We know that if we can have someone who's in family medicine and they train with us in Duluth and they spend some time in the clinic in Ely, Minnesota or International Falls, Minnesota training, we know that they are much more likely to develop those connections with those communities and want to come back and practice there. When they train in Minneapolis, that's where their social network becomes, and it's better for them to stay there. And I'll give you an example of what's happened in Minnesota. So since 2023, there are 7% fewer practicing physicians in the state of Minnesota now than there were in 2023. There are more physicians practicing in the 11-county metro area than there were in 2023. So we know where we might not know where they came from, but we know where they're not. But we do know that if we can train in the small communities, train in rural areas, people's affinity becomes connected to those, and they're much more likely, even if they do leave for a while, to come back. But we do know that if they train there, they will stay.
Seems to me, though, they're incentivized differently in the rural area versus the urban area.
Can you tell me more about what you mean?
There's more
by that?
Money to be made, it seems to me, in an urban area versus a rural area. Is that part of the problem?
We haven't found money to be a sufficient motivator for people to do that. Quality of life, connection with the communities. I'd also say that there are many more two professional families than there were, let's say, back in 1975. If she's a general surgeon, her husband, if she's married and has a partner, is much more likely to be an electrical engineer. You give me any surgeon and I can find a place for them. Ely, there might not be a role for an electrical engineer, even with remote work. So it's matching the family to the community, not just the physician.
I want to talk about access and equity, access to care. We spoke earlier about healthcare being a right.
Yes.
But I don't think we can say today that people of less means have the same access to care as people with big bucks.
Right.
So what are you doing to impact that issue?
Well, first of all, as we were just talking about, it's where is the care provided? So if the care is provided in that small community, that certainly reduces the barriers to access. What do we consider as the basic benefit set, and how do we make sure that people have that? This will require not just a strong healthcare system, but a strong public health system. We have three aspirational aims at Essentia Health: engaged and inspired people. They're the people that deliver that care each and every day. Zero preventable harm. How can we deliver healthcare safely and with the highest quality as we possibly can every minute of every day? And as you know, healthcare is 24/7, 365. Our third aspirational aim is health and vitality with our communities. What can we do inside of our communities, whether it's about behavioral health, help within the schools, clean water, clean air, all those things that we know that contribute to the health? How can we work outside the walls of our clinic and hospitals and be able to promote that? That requires a strong partnership with communities, with public health, and then the organized healthcare system in order to be able to deliver that.
I asked you earlier if the United States could learn anything from Canada.
Yes.
Can North Dakota learn anything from Minnesota or Wisconsin, or Minnesota learn anything from North Dakota and Wisconsin to improve the system, and if so, what can they learn?
I think each of us in every state can learn from another state. My belief is that there's always somebody out there that may be doing it better than we doing that, and shameless plagiarization and taking what they've learned rather than I having to walk in the shoes that they've already stepped in.
How about from a policy perspective?
I think that's sometimes difficult to say. I do believe that in Minnesota, the volume to value is more mature in that state, basically through partnerships that we have with insurance companies and others. But I see that developing in Wisconsin and in North Dakota as well. I believe those shared conversations, and I also believe that labels generally don't get us very far. So if someone doesn't want to adopt something because it came from Minnesota to North Dakota, that's probably not helpful. I would say the same thing from something that comes from North Dakota to Minnesota. If it's labeled, well, what do they know about it? Likely not helpful. I would also say urban and rural. We are very effective at delivering healthcare in rural areas. I believe it's more about the healthcare than it is about the rural areas. Can some of the things that we do to deliver healthcare be adopted by someone in an urban area? Definitely. Are there things that they do that we could adopt better? Definitely. That free exchange of information without judging where the information comes from, I think is very, very helpful.
My guest has been Essentia Health CEO, Dr. David Herman. He's also the chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Appreciated our conversation.
Thanks very much, Greg. I appreciate it and look forward to talking again about this.
I'll look forward to that.
Still to come on Main Street, our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, and I walk through this week's news in North Dakota, and movie lovers take note. Madeline unveils picks 20 to 11 from his all-time favorites, featuring daring choices, overlooked gems, and a few spicy surprises along the way. That's still ahead. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
There's our music we like to hear on Thursday. It's time that Dave Thompson and I are going to walk through the news of the week here in North Dakota. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave Thompson, of course, is our longtime veteran news director. Dave, a North Dakota lawmaker, passed away and was remembered for her quiet strength. What do you remember about Representative Cindy Schreiber-Beck?
Well, talk about somebody who was a model legislator. She kept her head down. She worked on things. She was very much an advocate for education. She was also an advocate for agriculture and an advocate for aviation because she worked in the aviation field with her longtime husband. She was just, everybody liked her. Both parties liked her a lot, said that she was one of these people who just wanted to do the right thing. And, you know, this is kind of a sad because we've lost two legislators. Now we've lost Cindy Schreiber-Beck, but before that, we lost a Fargo legislator, Josh Christie.
Dave, I don't know that listeners really appreciate the relationships that people like you have with these longtime lawmakers.
Yeah, and you build those up. You have a trust relationship, and there are certain people you just love talking to. And Cindy Schreiber-Beck was one of the people I really liked talking to.
Well, Dave, let's continue with the air travel, air service, airline trend here. Passenger air travel continues to set records in North Dakota. In fact, April was a real record setter.
Absolutely. It was the busiest April in state history. 104,271 commercial boardings. That was 11% over April last year. A lot ahead of course, the COVID years. Since the COVID years, it has come back. The aeronautics industry in North Dakota has come back with a vengeance. And I mean, March was a record setter as well. And Kyle Warner, who is the director of the Aeronautics Commission, is expecting this to continue. Said airlines are taking notice. They're bringing in bigger planes. They're providing more flights. And they're, you know, got a few more destinations that they've added to.
Dave, I would hope that they make the connecting flights leave just a little bit later from Fargo. That would be nice for me. But I do appreciate a new parking garage, more gates. And it's just evident that air travel in North Dakota is very strong. Dave, you wrote a story with the headline, Water Spending for 2025 through 2027. Lots going on relative to water in the state.
Yes. Now, water money comes from the oil taxes in North Dakota, set aside in the Natural Resources Trust Fund. And yeah, they had to cut back from some of the requests, but still there's a lot of money going to be spent for such things like the Northwest Area Water Supply Project, which could soon receive Missouri River water, which they've been working on for years. And of course, expansion of the Southwest Pipeline Project. They have the Flood Control Project in Minot. They're going to be working on the Red River Valley Water Supply Project, which will bring Missouri River water to the Red River Valley. It's all being worked on, but it's not the point where they can actually spend the money right now and do everything this year. They're going to have to do it over several years.
Dave, as you have reported all week long, rains have been very beneficial to those who are trying to halt fires in the state.
Absolutely. It has helped firefighters. It's helped hold the number of wildfires down. The only thing that there's a question of, is this enough to kind of break the drought? Well, there's some mixed feelings on that. The National Weather Service is saying, well, not yet, but there are other private forecasters who have said, yeah, we think maybe the drought is broken. Just given the amount of rain that we've had in some parts of North Dakota, Bismarck had 5 inches of rain. There were parts of western North Dakota that had 6 inches of rain. I think in Fargo, you had about 4 to 5 inches of rain too.
We had plenty. That's for sure. Things are awfully green, which is a nice benefit. Dave, there's some discussion about what teacher salary negotiations may look like in the coming year or two. What's the latest there?
Well, the latest is, this is, of course, negotiation season. They're sitting down, teachers are sitting down with school boards to negotiate contracts for the next year. And the president of the union that represents teachers in North Dakota says negotiations might be somewhat difficult this year because the legislature only approved 2.5% increases each year in state funding for schools. Archuleta says there was really a lot of talk in the interim that there was going to be 4 and 4. It's now 2.5 and 2.5. And he would like, and I'm talking about Nick Archuleta, the president of North Dakota United, he would like to tell people that the fight is not necessarily between the school boards and the teachers. The fight is to get more funding from the state for schools. So he said, yeah, it's going to be a little tight, but he's hoping that teachers will be able to hang in there. We've lost some teachers, he says, because our pay is down to 40th in the country.
Dave, what else are you going to be reporting on in the near future?
Well, I've got a very interesting story. There's a group from the University of Minnesota that's coming to visit Basin Electric. And they're looking at Basin because the researcher who is leading the class is talking about the transformation of the electric grid and how we're getting our electricity. And they are looking at Basin Electric as one of the innovators in that.
We'll be listening, Dave. Thanks for joining us for our weekly review of the news. And we hope you have a great, maybe a little bit longer weekend, Dave.
Thank you. I hope you do too.
There's the fanfare we look forward to each and every week here on Main Street. It's another edition of our movie review with our movie reviewer extraordinaire, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Greg.
We're going to have a curveball thrown at our listeners. Matt, why don't you tell our listeners what's up here, and then we're going to walk through a pretty fascinating list.
Well, the product in theaters right now is so bad, right? I mean, we reviewed Clown in a Cornfield last week, and need I say more, right? Outside of Sinners, there's not a lot to see. So this week and next week, we're going to count down my 20 top films of all time. We'll do 20 through 11 today, and then numbers 10 through 1 next week. In 2 weeks, I'll be back with a regular review of Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, and then in the weeks after that, The Phoenician Scheme, Friendship, F1 with Brad Pitt and Javier Bardem. So they're coming down very soon, but we thought we would just do this and see what listeners think of this, because yeah, there's really not a lot to see right now in theaters until Mission Impossible opens this coming weekend.
I feel like Casey Kasem now. We're going to walk through
the
top lists. And before we begin here, give our listeners a hint of a couple other lists you've maintained.
Yeah, my friend John Bodine and I, a couple years ago, did like an all-time top 100 comedy list, top 100 movies of all time, top 100 Westerns. And I keep a very, very detailed list of movies on a Word document of mine, year by year, like what I would have voted for, this kind of thing. And I started that years ago. And so it's an easy reference for me to make. Now, you won't hear a lot of films in this list in the last 20 years. I do think films have to be around a while to kind of make this kind of a list. I do like films like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Mulholland Drive in the last 20 years that kind of, I think, will start making lists like this, Parasite. But yeah, let's go through it and see what listeners think. And, you know, there's going to be disagreements and some films people haven't seen, but this is my personal, what I think are the best films I've ever seen.
Just to drive Matt's point home, the oldest movies we're going to talk about today are from 1927, and the newest movies in this list is from, the newest movie is from 1979.
Right.
So Matt, let's start with a movie from 1966, A Man for All Seasons.
Yeah, I love this movie. This is one of the great period English, you know, royalty intrigue films ever made, directed by Fred Zinnemann, who remains kind of an underrated director, not as well known as some directors of his time, even though he won two directing Oscars. So this is about Sir Thomas More opposing Henry VIII's divorce, and it's just lovely to look at. The cinematography and the costumes and the set design are so magnetic, they almost pop off the screen. But Paul Scofield is Thomas More. He's the key to the film. He plays Thomas More, wins the Oscar for Best Actor. Saw this in high school, and I've seen it numerous times since, and I never get tired of it. Often on TCM if you haven't seen it.
And number 19, Day for Night.
Day for Night is directed by Francois Truffaut, French filmmaker who's long since passed away. This came out in 1973, won a bunch of awards. Day for Night is a movie term used in the film industry when you try to shoot night scenes, but it's during the daytime, or you're trying to, you know, you have to make it look like it's nighttime, even though you're shooting in the daytime. So it's a movie about the making of a movie, and it's so well done, and it's so interesting and funny. It's about these, it's, you know, it's shot, this French movie being made. Truffaut plays the director, and it's this drama that goes on inside the making of this movie. So it's a movie within a movie. And Truffaut really pulls it off, and it's just one of the great films of the 1970s if people have not seen it.
Number 18 on your list is the first on this list that I remember seeing, Matt, a fun one, American Graffiti.
I think it's George Lucas's best film. I know my Star Wars friends don't like it when I tell them that, but I think American Graffiti is, it's a moment in time, Craig. You watch this movie set in 1962, the last night before these college kids go off to college, cruising, driving. It's based a lot on Lucas's upbringing in Modesto, California, the car culture of California of that time. Wall-to-wall soundtrack on the radios as people are driving around. That was revolutionary. Francis Coppola produced this. He was Lucas's friend and kind of benefactor in the early days. But it's amazing. It launched the careers of Ron Howard, who already was kind of a child star. Cindy Williams, Richard Dreyfuss, a lot of people. Harrison Ford shows up, right, as the guy who wants to challenge John Milner to the big car race. But love this movie. Never get tired of watching it.
Was Wolfman Jack the DJ that we listened to?
He was. He's in the movie right at the end.
great movie. Mm. Cruise in Maine was a thing in our town, Matt. Yeah. I don't know if it was.
It was in Oaks.
For you and
it didn't take very long to cruise Maine in Oaks, but we did it.
All right, number 17, North by Northwest.
I think it's Alfred Hitchcock's best film to this date. I know, you know, talking about Hitchcock's best film is like talking about what's the best Beatles song. There's so many to choose from, but this is entertaining from start to finish. Cary Grant, Eva Marie Saint, James Mason, brilliant as the villain. Great soundtrack. You know, this chase starts in New York City, ends up on Mount Rushmore, right, in Rapid City, South Dakota, which makes it kind of local for people around here. But it's funny, it's tense, has some of the great set pieces we'll ever see from Hitchcock. You know, the auction room scene is so well done, the Mount Rushmore stuff at the end. I think it's his best film. It's his most entertaining film, I think. And a little more, you know, Vertigo gets more attention, I think, in top 10 lists from critics, which I like Vertigo a lot. But North by Northwest is just, I think, a little more entertaining and more fun, too.
Matt, my favorite Hitchcock movie is Rear Window, but that's not on your list.
It's definitely in my top 100. It's a lot of people say Rear Window is their favorite Hitchcock, and I can certainly abide by that. I just like North by Northwest a little bit better.
All right, number 16, a movie I also remember, Apocalypse Now.
So this will be
the
first entrance of Francis Ford Coppola movies on our list from this week and next week. That gives you a hint, doesn't it, Craig? What be coming later? But you know, Coppola has had an up and down career, but in the end, he probably directed three of the 20 best American films ever made. Of course, with Apocalypse Now. I saw this at the Lark Theater in Fargo when I was 14. My dad and I drove up to see it. I begged him to go first weekend. We watched it, and it's a great memory with my dad to let a 14-year-old go to this because he knew I was interested in movies like this. I think this is a film, when it first came out, critics weren't too sure about it, but over the years they've realized this is a masterpiece. I think the initial criticism of the film was the last half hour of the film when Martin Sheen finds Marlon Brando finally. Some thought that was an anticlimactic ending. I think now when I rewatch it again, it's the appropriate ending. There's so many good lines in this, Craig. Oh, my goodness. I mean, the narration from Sheen, you know, where he talks about they charged Kurtz with murder, and he says, charging a man with murder in this place is like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500. You know, just amazing lines like that as he narrates and kind of watches and observes things. Lawrence Fishburne, 18 years old, his first movie. Dennis Hopper's in this. Frederick Forrest. And who can forget Robert Duvall as Colonel Kilgore, you know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. So I think in the end, this is one of the two best films about Vietnam. We'll talk about the other one next week. But just love this movie. Great soundtrack, too, of course, with the Doors singing The End.
So powerful. All right, Matt, we're not quite halfway through the list. Number 15, The Wild Bunch.
So 1969, Sam Peckinpah, this was the movie that really kind of broke open violence in movies. The final 20-minute, you know, gory shootout with the guys, William Holden, Ernest Borgnine, Ben Johnson, and Warren Oates, you know, going into this Mexican compound down in Mexico, and all hell breaks loose. And it's a ballet of violence is what I would talk about, how I would describe it, how Peckinpah does this. This is a Western, four outlaws kind of at the end of their rope, end of their career, who do one last job to kind of make a lot of money, and things go haywire as they often do in these one last job movies. But it's a Western that I think kind of enlarged the scope of the Western when people saw it. It was mutilated in terms of editing when it first came out, but now the final original Peckinpah cut of 2 hours, 25 minutes is usually what is shown on film and or on television if you see it on TCM or HBO or whatever. So if you like Westerns, you got to watch The Wild Bunch.
Two films back-to-back here from a long time ago, Matt. This one, Napoleon from 1927.
Yeah, this is a film by French director Abel Gance. I saw this in college, and the editing in this film is just, it's so good. You can't believe this was made in 1927. It's about Napoleon's career, and some of the scenes are almost like surrealistic, dreamlike. It's like 4 hours long. It's a hard film to get a hold of. It's really kind of a film that is hard to find on DVD, hard to find streaming. And so I apologize by putting this in there because it's a hard film to see. But if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about, how revolutionary this movie was.
Also a movie from quite a while ago, Sunrise.
So F.W. Murnau directed this. It was the first winner and only winner of the Oscar for Unique and Artistic Picture in 1928. And it's about this farmer, him and his wife go to the city on a day, on a weekend. And it's, you know, it's got some early sound in it. Even though this is a silent film, you see early sound effects. The cinematography is amazing. The story is amazing. This often appears on a lot of critics' top 10, top 20 lists and remains a masterpiece. We showed this at the Fargo Theater a couple years ago to honor my friend Tony McRae, who had passed away, who loved this movie. We had a good attendance. So Sunrise is a film that is available if you want to find it somewhere streaming or buy it on DVD.
Two more on Matt's top 20 list that we want to talk about today. This is number 12, All the President's Men, all about Watergate.
I assume you've seen this one, Craig. Most people have.
Actually met Bob Woodward, too, by the way.
Yeah, Robert Redford plays Bob Woodward. Dustin Hoffman plays Carl Bernstein. Jason Robards wins the Supporting Actor Oscar as Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post. This is one of those movies, Craig, where you know the ending, right? We know Nixon resigns. We know the ending. But how do we get there? And it's like a mystery that these reporters track down and figure out, was there something other than just this third-rate burglary at the Watergate building in the Democratic headquarters? What's going on here? And as we've learned since then, the cover-up is always worse than the crime, or sometimes it is worse than the crime, and I think that's the message here. But the film is really just analytical, and every time it's on, I end up watching 15 or 20 minutes of it. The dialogue is great. The script is great. The acting is amazing. Hal Holbrook as Deep Throat, who can forget him meeting Redford in the car park, you know, to divulge information. I was fascinated by Watergate as a 9-year-old watching the hearings on television and seeing this movie come to life. It's an amazing movie made by Robert Redford's production company at the time and directed by Alan Bakula. And anybody interested in the media, in journalism, should watch this movie.
Matt, I also like The Post a lot, but it's not on your list.
I don't really care for The Post much. It's okay. It's like the C-team version of All the President's Men, I would say.
Not even the B-team.
Tom Hanks is not as good as Ben Bradley as Jason Robards was. We can talk about The Post another time, but I think it's subpar Spielberg, I guess. But I mean, I'm glad people saw it and it came out, but it pales in comparison to the artistry of All the President's Men.
Post, of course, was about the Washington mm-hmm. Post decision to publish the Pentagon
yes.
papers. All right, Matt, that brings us to our last movie today of your top 20 list. This will be number 11, The Best Years of Our Lives.
My father's all-time favorite movie, 1946, about returning veterans from World War II. And it really covered an issue that had not been covered, and that is how people adjust after war, PTSD. This was not talked about after World War II, as you well know, Craig, but it follows three veterans, played by Frederick March, Dana Andrews, and Harold Russell, who wins the Supporting Actor Oscar, a non-professional actor who lost his hands in World War II. So he has hooks on his hands. And for William Wyler, the director, to cast a non-professional actor in this role was groundbreaking in 1946. You would have thought they would have cast a major star, put hooks on his hands, you know, do something like that. But it really makes the film, gives it that realism that you're looking for. My dad, if this film was on, my dad would still watch a half hour or 45 minutes of it every time. It captured a moment in time of returning war veterans that really caught the public fancy, and it won a lot of Oscars, Best Picture that year, and it's a film I really love. It's 3 hours long, but it's once you start watching it, it's hard to stop watching it.
All right, we reviewed these movies number 11 through 20 in Matt's top 20 list. Matt, again, the movies were from number 20 up, A Man for All Seasons, Day for Night, American Graffiti, North by Northwest, Apocalypse Now, The Wild Bunch, Napoleon, Sunrise, All the President's Men, and The Best Years of Our Lives. So Matt, our trivia question today, of those movies, which won the most Academy Awards?
I think it's The Best Years of Our Lives with 7 Oscars.
That's exactly right. Matt, it's been great to review this list. We'll look at movies 1 through 10 next week here on Main Street. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
This is Decoder Datebook for May 22nd. According to its website, the purpose of the North Dakota Medical Association is to advocate for North Dakota's physicians. to advance the health and promote the well-being of the people of North Dakota. Much of the organization's work is carried out by five commissions representing socioeconomics, ethics, legislation, medical services, and public relations. These commissions meet to discuss topics important to North Dakota doctors and residents, then make recommendations to the association. Healthcare on the frontier in Dakota Territory was rudimentary at best, and often a matter of self-care. Doctors were in short supply and had to be prepared for everything: broken bones, gunshot wounds, and epidemics like cholera and typhoid. Military posts, such as Camp Hancock and Fort Abraham Lincoln, ensured the presence of physicians who provided care to both military personnel and civilians. The first doctor in Bismarck was a retired Army physician, Dr. Henry R. Porter. He opened a practice in Bismarck after completing his Army contract, having survived the defeat of the 7th Cavalry at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. These early doctors were adventurous and solitary figures. They often rode many miles to treat a sick or injured patient. They rarely had nurses to assist and seldom had the chance to consult with a colleague. So it made sense for them to band together for mutual support. Two Bismarck physicians organized an informal meeting in 1881 that led to the first meeting of the Territorial Medical Association in 1882. In 1887, a temporary organization formed in Larimore. It later evolved into the North Dakota Medical Association. On this date in 1888, the group met in Grand Forks. A constitution and bylaws were drafted and officially adopted at the annual meeting the following year, 1889. Medical care in North Dakota has come a long way since the days of the lone doctor riding through the wilderness. Over the decades, the North Dakota Medical Association has supported the advancement of medicine across the state and continues to serve physicians to improve health care for all North Dakotans. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
In Minneapolis, the intersection where a police officer killed George Floyd 5 years ago is now adorned with flowers and inscribed with the names of other victims of police violence.
This space has grown and evolved to be a space that has been a space of sanctity and protest for people of all different backgrounds.
Reflections from George Floyd Square on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. He asks the question, if not diversity, equity, and inclusion, then what? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. On Memorial Day, we'll have a special program in this time slot. The USS Indianapolis was sunk shortly after secretly delivering components for the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima, linking its tragic fate to a pivotal moment in World War II. We hope you have a wonderful North Dakota Memorial Day weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you again Tuesday, right back here on Main Street.